Welcome back in to the Eye on College Basketball podcast here with CBS Sports and CBSSports.com. I hope you're doing well. This is Friday edition. Recording this on Thursday for full transparency. Clark Kellogg is coming back on and joining me, and it's a pleasure to get him back. And thank you again for coming in and listening, everyone. If you haven't subscribed, feel free to do so on iTunes if you like. And Clark, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. How are you doing as we're only a few days out from Christmas here?
Oh, I'm excited and doing well, Mac. Good to be back with you. I tune in on occasion to your other guests, and you're still doing a platinum star job, so it's good to be in the saddle with you.
Well, the check's in the mail, Clark. I can't thank you enough for that. I very much appreciate it. So, first time having you on this season, and you do a great job calling the games, but I love getting you on because I like to hear you expand more on some stuff that you drop in. You know, when you're doing the games, it's usually about those two teams involved. Maybe you have an opportunity to go here or there with an issue in college basketball, with a conference that might be doing well, or a trend, or here or there. But now we can really expand and let you talk. So I want to open it up broad first here. I mean, through the first 6 weeks of the season, basically, it's, you know, I kind of feel like college basketball's had a decent start. It might be lurching along a little bit. We don't right now have a player that you can say that's the face of college basketball right now, because Zeller hasn't been quite as good as you might expect. Nerlens Noel at Kentucky hasn't been quite as good as you'd expect. But what are your impressions overall, first 6 weeks of the season, where college hoops is?
Well, you know what? It's a work in progress, and I agree with you. There hasn't been a clear-cut face of college basketball in terms of a player consistently performing at a high level that captures the imagination of folks. With production and charisma, we haven't had that. But there are a number of good players out there that are slowly but surely building their resume towards player of the year recognition. You look at a guy like Doug McDermott. Seeing his dad as I'm thinking of Doug.
I do it too.
But Doug is having a really solid year for an outstanding team in Creighton. You take a look at Kansas and the way the freshman, the redshirt freshman, Ben McLemore is playing. He's been outstanding of late. You mentioned Cody Zeller not being quite up to par as expected, but he is only a sophomore. But I like the fact, quite honestly, getting away from the individual players, Matt,
yep.
I like the fact that there's a pretty strong contingent of non-power conference teams that look like they have the makings of running deep into March. And I'm excited to see how that all plays out. You know, at the top, we've got Duke and Louisville and Michigan. Indiana is still in that mix. Arizona, Syracuse. But after that, you've got some really quality non-power conference teams out there that I think are going to be really hard to knock out of the tournament once we get to that point in March.
Yeah, you mentioned it, and certainly you mentioned McDermott, Doug, and his dad, Greg. They're a really solid team. What about a team like Vegas or a team like New Mexico? You know, they're almost in that in-between. They're not considered among the power conference teams because, you know, the Mountain West is a great league. It's just not considered a power conference league. But it's still ahead of, you know, a Valley or a CAA. Listen, New Mexico's still undefeated. Vegas, they don't have Mike Mosier for another few weeks here because he had a dislocated elbow, but they look really good. That conference in general, I mean, I think that might be a storyline we see come even to more fruition in the next two or three weeks, because the Mountain West in general, Clark, looks to be in prime shape, and those are kind of the two programs at the forefront. But even San Diego State, Wyoming's still undefeated. Boise State is 7-2 and has had a really good year. Colorado State, I mean, that to me, it's not a sexy storyline, but we could have a sneaky Mountain West there where you've got five or six teams that are worthy of a bid. I think that's great.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And the Mountain West historically has been an outstanding basketball conference. We know that, Matt.
Yeah.
Multiple bids come out of that conference pretty much every year. And typically they have a team that is able to get to that second weekend. And you named all of the teams that I think are tournament caliber teams. When you look at it right now, I've not seen Wyoming yet. I do know the coach. He recruited me when he was an assistant
at
Cleveland State way back in the late 70s. Larry Shiat are doing a fantastic job out in Wyoming, and obviously still with Steve Alford has a really good team. I've seen New Mexico just once on TV and very impressed with their perimeter play. They do a good job attacking the rim, scoring the ball in the paint at the free throw line, and pretty solid defensively. UNLV, I think when you look at Bennett, he perhaps has maybe stepped to the top of the class in terms of outstanding freshman performers, and there are a number of them out there having outstanding years, but Bennett is a man. I mean, he's well put together, pretty skilled, and off to a terrific start. The fact that they don't have Moser, though, I think keeps them a peg below where they potentially can be, assuming he can come back at full strength. But I like what the Mountain West represents. And again, when you look at non-power conference schools or those schools in between the lesser Division I conferences and the power conferences, you've got an awful lot to like and enjoy if you're a college basketball fan as this season unfolds.
On the other side of the country, I did want to, you know, give you a chance to talk a little bit about Jim Boeheim. We discussed it on the Wednesday podcast with Jeff Gooden and Gary Parrish, and him getting to 900, that accomplishment. But, you know, our own colleague Doug Gottlieb, Doug Gottlieb went on TV earlier this week and said that there's no program more overrated than Syracuse. And he gave Boeheim his props. But, I mean, and Gottlieb, who's come on a pod a couple of times, been great with it. He's not shy about doing this at all. I wanted your thoughts on Boeheim getting to this mark, you know, 900, the same school, nearly 50 years with that school, if you consider his playing days and his assistant days, and your impression of doing it at Syracuse. I mean, is that an overrated program, or is what Boeheim done even, you know, understated by some?
Well, I would start with an understatement, because you think about how long he's been there associated with Syracuse, and you chronicled it. I mean, 5 decades between playing, assistant coaching, and head coaching. We won't see that again, I don't think. We certainly won't see it in my lifetime. I don't think we'll see a player or a coach have that type of tenure at a place and the level of success. And you can argue quality of non-conference schedule and so forth, but you can't argue the consistency and the excellence that Jim Boeheim has represented there. I wouldn't say it's an overrated program, because they've consistently won 20-plus games. On occasion, they may have underachieved in the tournament, but that isn't the full measure of a program. I think it's consistency. I think it's excellence over a period of time. And when you look at those, and then I like the way Jim Boeheim coaches. I've always been a huge fan of how confident and freely his players play. Some people would look at that in years past as being a little undisciplined. I look at it as being able to understand the kind of room you need to give your players to play, and then not trying to keep your hands on the steering wheel of the game as a coach. And nobody's done that any better than Jim Boeheim. So I'm a huge fan, and I would respectfully disagree with our new colleague, Mr. Gottlieb, in regards to Syracuse being one of the most overrated programs in the country.
Maybe a couple weeks down the road, we'll get you and Doug on the podcast at the same time.
Okay, there you go. That's what we'll have to do, man.
Little,
we'll have to square off.
Little tete-a-tete. Hey, Boeheim was a relatively young coach when you started your career. Did he or anyone on Syracuse recruit you, or did Big East programs in general, did any of them seriously pursue you?
No, not at the time, because I think, in part, that league was just getting started, and they pretty much stayed within a certain region of recruiting. And for the most part, most of your programs back in the late 70s kind of recruited regionally, when you think about it. Clearly, there were some programs that would go national, but it wasn't nearly the type of national recruiting that we see in this day and age, in part because of TV exposure. But I was recruited by Michigan, Ohio State, Notre Dame, and Kentucky, the hardest. Those were the only four schools that I visited, and obviously all high-quality schools and programs even back then. But nobody from the Big East pursued me, and I don't know if I would have even wasted their time had they shown interest. I was pretty much locked into staying reasonably close to my hometown of Cleveland.
As we record this podcast, Jabari Parker, the number two recruit for the class of 2013, is getting ready to make his announcement. I think he might make it before we're done recording here, and then I'll pass along the news to you because Clark's actually not near a TV. But I do want to ask you, since we're on that, So, like, you've got these kids, these, you know, top-rated recruits, and there's so much media attention, and just, you know, recruiting itself has become a business. I mean, guys now make their livings off of following what 15, 16, 17-year-old kids do, how they play, the decisions they make, and the decisions they don't make. For you, though, when it came down to it, you mentioned the four schools that that it came down to. What was it that made you choose Ohio State? Because I think sometimes we want to look for a certain reason here or there, and it might be legitimate. Yeah. But I think other times, like, I just try and remember being 17 and the things that might have mattered to me when picking a school. I went to a lowly D3 school. So, but for you, can you specifically remember the moment or one or two, maybe even tiny things that made you lean?
Oh, yeah, no question. I can remember clearly. It came down after I visited those four schools, was really comfortable at all four places, ended up knocking my list down to Michigan and Ohio State. And the deciding factors were, one, Ohio State had a terrific nucleus of players there in Herb Williams and Jim Smith, Calvin Ranji, Carter Scott, and were looking for a forward with my skill set, kind of a do-it-all forward. And I felt like I could plug and play right away and be part of a team that would have a chance to win a conference and national championship. The other thing, I'm a Cleveland native. Ohio State is the state school, and the guys that I would be joining all were Ohio guys, and they made a real impression on me in terms of my recruitment. And even though it wasn't particularly called the Buckeye Nation at the time, Matt, the whole state recruited me. I've got, my dad probably still has boxes of letters I got from people all over the state about the benefit of being an Ohio kid going to Ohio State and what that would mean even post-basketball days. And even though I was only 17, 18 years old at the time, I had started through the direction of my parents and some other folks that were important in my life, started thinking about, as best a 17 and 18-year-old could think about, when it would be over, and felt like having a degree from Ohio State would have some value being an Ohio kid playing basketball there. So those were the factors. And I didn't want to go too far away from home. I mentioned that earlier, but those other things really were the things that turned the tide in favor of the Buckeyes. And I'm thankful and grateful that that's where I landed, because it's been a great part of my life since getting down there in 1979.
Now, Parker's making this decision. You know, he's a senior. He's doing it in mid-December. Nerlens Noel waited until the spring last year. How far, like, how, you know, was it early, late junior year, early senior year? Did you stretch it out until?
Hey, there was no early signing period, Matt.
I know, but I didn't know how this works, you know, back in the 70s.
Right. I'm ancient, man. I'm antiquated. I'm a fossil in the eyes of some. So back in the late 70s, there was only one time to sign.
Okay.
And that was in the spring of your senior year.
Okay.
So I had gone through my senior season, Joe V. Hall and Digger Phelps and Johnny Orr and Eldon Miller and their assistant coaches had been throughout. They had been to my high school games. Eldon Miller and the coaching staff came to my high school graduation party at my house.
Wow.
That's how different it was then. But that was after, obviously, I had signed.
Yes.
And but it wasn't until the spring that you could sign. And in some ways, I'm a little ashamed of this, but even before ESPNU and CBSSports.com, there was a press conference about my signing. And it's a little embarrassing now, but that was big news back in April of 1979, where I was going to end up going to school. And it was clearly overdone at that time, and it's only grown in magnitude since then.
Wow. So you're saying overdone in 79. Did you have the hats? Did you have anything? Were you just at a table?
Yeah. I didn't have a hat of the university, but I was a Mad Hatter as a person. I had a collection of hats that I wore as part of my signature statement and own personal
flair. I'm loving this.
So I had a nice straw hat on and a nice little sweater vest. In that particular day and age, I was probably a bit of a trendsetter in terms of the lids that I would sport. My Scott pieces were high level.
I am loving the direction the podcast has suddenly taken here. If I can get my hands on anything from that era of you, rest assured, I might have to expose it.
Oh, you can track it down. You'll find that it was actually, I've got pictures of it, so it's somewhere.
Oh, that's great.
I don't know where you track it down, but you'd be able to find it was at the St. Joseph High School Library, which is where I went to high school. That's where we had it. My mom and dad both were there, and I had on a nice straw hat and a polka dot shirt and a little sweater.
Look at that. All right. we'll go to a separate issue here. If you know, the Jabari Parker thing was the story of college basketball late Thursday. Early Thursday, Mike Cabongo, Yahoo Sports reported late Wednesday night that Mike Cabongo will not play at all this season for Texas. The back story to this is basically Cabongo wanted to get an idea of where he would be drafted if he left after his freshman year at Texas. So in the spring, he used a guy that's basically an agent to get private workouts. You can't really do that. How did he pay for it? You know, who paid for the travel? All of that stuff. And because of this, the NCAA brought him in. And the belief is he probably would have been hit for 3 to 10 games if he'd owned it, but he fibbed or maybe flat out lied to the NCAA. We don't know the details. So he's done for the year. Wanted your reaction to the fact that if Cabongo's done, not, you know, the bigger, yeah, Texas is maybe now not a tournament team, but the bigger issue is, you know, this rule, the NCAA's ruling. What do you think when you heard the news? What are your thoughts now, Clark?
Well, I tell you what, it's disappointing on a number of levels. One, I think in terms of the opportunity young men have to explore their potential as draft choices, has been laid out pretty clearly in their favor. And there's no reason to have to violate those rules to be able to find out what your draft status might be. The NCAA has made it possible for you to do that within the rules. And that's reasonable. The other side of it is that if, in fact, you come under investigation, it's been made clear that you need to be forthcoming with the information, and that should be a standard mode of operating no matter what the circumstances are, that you are forthright, you're candid, and you tell the truth, because there are tremendous consequences. The old saying is that oftentimes the cover-up can be worse than the crime.
Yeah.
Well, this is a case in point. We experienced it at Ohio State with our beloved coach Jim Tressel. That was a situation very similar. If, in fact, we have the facts as it relates to Cabongo, if there was some indication that he had stepped outside of the rules based on what the NCAA had, he needed to be forthcoming. So I feel terrible for the young man, but there's a responsibility and accountability to telling the truth when you are in that situation. So it's a complicated issue, but basically my posture is, one, you have an opportunity to do what you wanted to do within bounds. There's a way to do it, to find out what your draft status is without stepping outside of the parameters. If you do and there's an investigation, then you need to be clean and own up to it and man up to that. And if you don't, then you're subject to these kind of consequences. So it's unfortunate for Cabongo, and it certainly hurts Texas. I would not discount them. I haven't watched them yet, but I do know their talent and personnel and the coaches there. I would not discount them as a tournament team quite yet.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah,
I wouldn't personally, because in some cases, Matt, and you've been around a little bit, adversity, no matter how significant, can really be a galvanizing force for a team and for players and allow them to come together in a way they wouldn't have otherwise and to achieve beyond what might be the expectation. I mean, we're seeing it in the NFL in some ways with the Indianapolis Colts. Chuck Pagano undergoes treatment for cancer, is diagnosed, and this team now on the verge of being an NFL playoff team when many people felt they might not win 5 or 6 games. So you have to kind of let that one play out.
I agree. Now, Texas is a really solid defensive team. I've seen them on TV a few times. The Chaminade loss was bad. They did not look much better at losing to USC. Really bad against Georgetown. But, yeah, you could be – they definitely – let's see what they can do. If you got a good defense, you've got a chance. I do want to follow up. I want to follow up with this. So, you are basically okay with the NCAA's rule book as it stands right now in regard to players testing the waters, because to me it seems like if it's just workouts here, what's the harm? Why do we want to really restrict what a player can do to get a true value and gauge on where he's going to be drafted? Because we're talking about, obviously, a lot of money, futures on the line, and it can come down to one or two things. And for some of these players and maybe their agents, you know, people around them, I know this can get so fuzzy, but you know what? If it's a difference between they think they're going to get picked top 15 or you might be between 23 and 25, well, you know what? That, for a lot of guys, could make a difference between going and coming back. To me, the rule book in this regard seems too ornate, but are you okay with where the NCAA is with underclassmen testing the waters, the legislation as it is now, or would you like to see the rule book thinned out a little bit?
I would like to see it modified. I would love to see it modified. No question about that. But the other side of the equation for me is there are so many guys, and again, we can't control this, but most of the guys that are exploring where they might be drafted shouldn't be even thinking about it. When you get right down to it, they have that right. But the reality is, if you have to do all of that digging to know whether or not you're going to be the 20th or 26th pick, you need to say you're behind in school. Okay. When I left, you couldn't even explore that back in 1982. So you had better been confident that when you looked at the landscape, based on whatever information you could get, and some of it you'd have to get under the table, but you had better have been confident that you were going to be, in my mind, at least a top 15 pick. It doesn't make any sense to leave otherwise. And you've got dire financial straits and other circumstances that lend themselves to you needing to explore somehow making a living. But in the vast majority of cases, Matt, if you're haggling and dickering about whether or not you're going to be 15th versus or 20th versus 30th, or whether you're going to be bottom of the first round or early second round, to me, there is no decision. Go back to school. Unless you have something else that means you that moves you toward needing to make. So many of these kids, Matt, are really trying to rush the experience of being a pro when they're not ready to try to make it a career. And that's the disheartening and unfortunate thing. There are clearly guys that you can see are ready to be pro players and ready to be top draft picks. And those guys should go if they're so inclined. But so many of these guys are just rushing into it, expecting to have a glamorous, high-paying life, not preparing for anything else, and doing themselves a disservice by jumping out there prematurely. And some of it's not their fault. Sometimes their family is encouraging it. Their agents are encouraging it. And it's not healthy and conducive for the vast majority. I mean, 30 guys get drafted in the first round every year. Four or five of them will average double figures in the NBA that rookie year. Four to five, maybe six or seven in a glorious year. And then 3 years from that year when they're drafted, half of them won't be playing in the league. So I've got a lot of issues with how things are done, but I would love to see the rules tweaked a little bit, but more importantly, I would like to see young men understand that jumping out there prematurely is not in their best interest. I don't care what anybody says.
Okay, so to spring off that, as someone who's been around the game for nearly, you know, for so long, for, you know, more than three decades here, and you know the college side, you know the pro side, I mean, you know both ends here, you hear people talk about consistently, you know, the infiltration of vested parties toward college players, whether that's agents or whether it's runners or whatever. Is this, in your opinion, from where you sit, from what you've seen, from what you've heard, you know, stuff behind closed doors, through the grapevine, confidential information, is it worse than it's ever been, just in terms of this, Clark, in terms of agents or quasi-agents or whatever trying to get in contact into the heads, into the circles of college players, or did that maybe hit its peak, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, and now it's a little more regulated? People within the NBA side kind of understand more of how you got to hold back, or is it just a pool of sharks still?
I think the pool of sharks exists, but I think the biggest change, Matt, quite honestly, is the fact that parents have become more a driver of this than even agents.
That's interesting because you don't hear that a lot.
No, you don't, but that's the reality that I see. Because in many cases, so many of these kids that are 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, and are being raised by kids, almost being raised by kids themselves in some cases. And therefore, they are also, because of the exposure and attention that being a pro athlete, particularly a basketball player, gets now with all of the various platforms we have to overhype what it is, get drunk by the Kool-Aid of what this looks like and what it means. And quite honestly, it is appealing if you have the giftedness and the opportunity to live your dream and play in the NBA. But so often, people are looking to have that happen far sooner than is productive. And a lot of times, it's those people that are closest to the individual athlete. It's not, I'm not going to lay it all on agents. They're a part of it, there's no doubt. I'm going to lay a good portion of it on those within the circle of influence of that individual player in many cases, which might be family, which might be a single mom that may not, and the dad might not be involved. And as a result, they're struggling financially. And it is easier to get into the ear of a mom or a family that may be struggling financially and start whispering these numbers and opportunities. And it puts pressure on the kid. And at 18, 19 years old, what are they going to know? And who are they to trust? And oftentimes it becomes a quagmire of poor decision making and trying to accelerate this dream of being a pro player when perhaps you'd be better served to continue to grow, not just as a player, but as a young man, so that you have a chance to make the most of this opportunity when it's the better time to present itself.
Very good. I like that a lot. By the way, Jabari Parker has chosen Duke, so he will attend Duke next season, number two recruit in 2013. Plenty listening to this podcast already realized this, but this is just breaking as we're recording this, so that should be.
Oh, that's well done, man. Very well. Way to segue that in there.
Yeah, man. Yeah, exactly. You know what? There you go. Nice little segue. So you can read all the reaction on Parker on CBSSports.com right now. We've got a number of stuff that's up. Wanted to touch briefly on the NCAA 75. This is the 75th anniversary of the NCAA tournament coming up this year. We have a lot of programming on CBS and CBS Sports Network. All sorts of stuff's going to be on the .com. Myself, Parrish Goodman, Jeff Borzello, going to have a lot of features and stuff up. But you're doing some of these programs. You've taped some of these programs. I just wanted you to relay what it was like to go back and you know, relive some stuff. Just, you know, it's very nostalgic, and we're at CBS, we're kind of just trying to do almost like a nice lead up here of nostalgia, 2 or 3 months leading into it. So how's it been to look back and see things maybe you discovered the second time around, might not have realized it as it was happening?
Well, the one thing that really continues to jump out at you almost year after year in the years that I've been able to be privileged to be part of the tournament coverage is just the magnitude of it.
Right.
And the memories, some that are always forefront in your mind because of the video montages you see and some of the other reminders that come up annually as we go down the road to the Final Four. But just how special it is for so many and how connected folks are to what the tournament has been over the years. Those special moments, those memorable moments, those unique performances, the history making by coaches and players and teams. But for me, quite honestly, the magnitude of this event and what it's become in terms of the exposure, the coverage, the excitement around it, and then having a chance to hear from my colleagues some of their memorable moments was kind of cool as I hung out with Bill Raftery and Greg Gumbel and Greg Anthony in our Behind the Mic show that we recorded a while back. Just being able to hear their take, and Greg Anthony's perspective so unique in that he's been on the broadcasting side for a while, but he actually was part of two elite college basketball teams, one that won it all and another that was on the verge of perhaps doing it. And so to hear his perspective and Bill Raftery's been around a long time to see so many different elements of the tournament. So that, to me, was as enjoyable. And then reconnecting with Greg Gumbel, who I spent 12 years in the studio with, as he's navigated countless partners in the studio. But that, to me, the magnitude, just how it's grown and the number of people that really rated as one of the top two, certainly top three sporting events on the calendar every year.
The what Clark refers to, the 75 years behind the mic and 75 years a coach's perspective, those will both air on CBS on Saturday, December 29th. So that'll be from 2 to 4. They're both one-hour shows right there on CBS. So that'll be good, nice little way to whet the appetite and turn to 2013 as we get ready. And then there's a whole bunch of other stuff, top 10 coaches, one-hit wonders. A lot of this stuff comes in February. Ultimate 75-year bracket, that'll come in March. It's going to be pretty awesome. And as we get closer, I'll try and get Clark back on maybe closer to February before, you know, March takes over all of our lives and talk a little bit more about that. But we'll wrap it up here. You do Kansas, Ohio State on Saturday. Awesome game.
Yep.
That's a really, really good game here. I love Kansas. Ohio State, I enjoy a lot. You know, they'd be getting a little more love if they had beaten Duke, which you can say they should have. Duke came back and won that game back at the end of November. But Ohio State looks good. Two things here. One, Kansas, you know, is this a team that you think could be a heavy favorite to win a title? And by that, I would say top three, you know, come later in February. Do you think that they're going to be a typical self team and that they're going to get better and better and better? And then on the Ohio State side of it, Deshaun Thomas is good. Kraft is good. But are they still missing maybe some sort of X factor there to create themselves into an elite team that a lot of people thought they would be or still could be?
Well, I'll start with Kansas first. Bill Self is one of the outstanding coaches in all of basketball. He is really, really platinum level in every way in terms of being a college basketball coach. He's one of the very best we have in the business. So, and he's got a team that I think is clearly national championship caliber. And I always look at the landscape of who do you have to compete against to be in that category. And Kansas will be right there. Two fifth-year seniors in Relaford and Whitney. Shot-blocking presence in Whitney that may be the best in the country. Elijah Johnson is understated but explosive as a point guard. They've got pieces. McLemore is tremendously impressive as a redshirt second-year freshman. So they've got all the ingredients, and they will get better barring injury. Ohio State, on the other hand, is also a work in progress. I think a legitimate top 12, top 15 caliber team right now, which could be a top 10 caliber team before it's all said and done. And the point you make, Matt, is a good one. Who emerges as that other consistent double-digit scorer? I think they'll be better defensively. It looks like Thad will play probably eight guys consistently, which is a little more. He usually plays six or seven with his teams in rotation. But they're athletic. They can defend. They can create offense off the defense. But can they find a consistent third scorer from amongst Lindzell Smith, Aaron Kraft? Actually, Kraft is not suited to being a scorer, and I don't know if he has to be. I really don't. I know people would like to see him score more, but I don't think he has to be. I think with Deshaun Thomas being a 20 to 30 point a game guy, Sam Thompson, Lindzell Smith, LaQuentin Ross off the bench, Shannon Scott, between those four, if they can get 18 to 22 points from two of those guys on a regular basis, then I think they've got a chance to be pretty good and reach their potential.
That's Clark Kellogg, everyone. You can follow him on Twitter at PacerCK, and CK is spelled out, or not spelled out, just letters C and K. And you're adapting to the tweet machine here, man. I got to see a little more from him, though. You're kind of sporadic.
You will. After we get into 2013, that's typically, I ramp it up in January.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's typically my all systems go mark, January, once we move towards that conference schedule. Then I'll start going crazier.
All right.
On Twitter.
I look forward to it. This was great. A lot of good stuff from you. I really appreciate it, Clark. Make sure you have a great rest of the holiday season. Safe New Year. Look forward to seeing you on the broadcasts. And we'll circle back around, try and get you on the pod again sometime after Valentine's Day. And thank you again.
All right. My pleasure, Matt. Great to be with you. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to you as well. And make sure you're getting plenty of rest, man, because I know the days are long for you, especially once we cross into 2013.
They are, but it's a non-labor of love here. Thanks again, Clark.
My pleasure, man.
We will be back on Monday. Christmas Eve does not mean the podcast stops. My colleague Jeff Borzella will be on. We'll have plenty to talk about and might even do a little bit of a Christmas theme with that. So you can look forward to that. We'll talk to you then. Thanks again for listening.